Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
Your life. Don't cross them lines.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Are pop music lyrics poetry? Well, Bob Dylan picked up his Nobel Prize for Literature in Sweden this week. You may not always listen to the words in the music of Pharrell or Taylor Swift. What's there when we do? This hour On Point, the poetry of popular music. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is it poetry to you? What's the line, the lyric that you love to recite? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Boulder, Colorado is Adam Bradley, professor of English and founding director of the Laboratory for Race and Popular Culture at the University of Colorado Boulder. His new book is The Poetry of Pop. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Adam Bradley in Colorado, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Why should we care if the lyrics of popular music are poetry or not?
I think most of us could go our entire lives without giving much thought to whether a song lyric is poetry. I mean, but think about the identity of song lyrics, the fact that these are among the most cherished, but also among the most disparaged lyrics that we have in the world, most disparaged words. I mean, people think of them as disposable. People think about them as things that you don't have to think about, that you can let slide right through your head. But where do we go to when our heart's broken, or when we fall in love, when we get married, or when we're missing someone who's gone? These words have power, they have force, they live in our lives, they're shot through our experiences. And that's what really brought me to exploring the heft of these words. What exactly is behind them?
I love that you've jumped into popular music to do this and brought this kind of close reading. But you're not in a camp that says, take the lyrics away from the music and stand them up all alone and put them up against the poems of the great poets. I mean, the music is part of what's going on by definition here.
The music is the poetry as well. That's exactly it, Tom. And a lot of people who resist the idea of thinking of song lyrics as poetry are thinking of them as solely the words alone, cut off from the way that they live in our ears and in the air. And what I wanted to do with this book was to say that in addition to looking at them on the page, which I think is a valuable and a rich exercise, mm-hmm. and something that opens up the listening experience, we all can also think about the poetry of sound, the way that a great singer inhabits words, the ways that the musical context actually either, you know, enshrine the language, as in a great Bob Dylan song where his solo acoustic guitar makes the words go to the front, or in a thrash metal song where the lyrics are essentially buried in the heat and the noise and the energy of the crashing electric guitars. There's a poetics to that as well.
I mean, we just heard Alabama Shakespeare at the top of Don't Want to Fight, and they're saying, my lines, your lines, don't cross them lines, what you like, what I like, we can't both be right. What's the case that you're making, Adam, that it's all poetry, the lyrics behind popular music, or some is poetry and some is not?
That's another great question, because, you know, poetry, we often use it as an honorific in our society.
Yeah.
We say, that's so poetic, that's so profound. But poetry is a descriptor. Poetry is simply a way of talking about what people do with words in concentrate. How do you use rhythm, rhyme, figurative language? How do you craft a voice, tell a story? That's what poetry has been. And from the very origins of the poetic tradition, certainly in the Western world and beyond, poetry and song were fused. You know, for the Greeks, poetry was the music, the lyrics that went to the music of the lyre. So it's only recently that we've separated, you know, drawn this sharp line of division between the poetry that inhabits song and the poetry that lives on the page.
We're going to dig in. We're going to listen and hear and get your kind of analysis of what's working and how. I mean, it's first, I guess, important to say, when you say pop music, you're not, as I dug into the book, it becomes clear right away, you're not talking just top 40 here. You're going across a wide range. You say everything that's not classical. You say, think of this book as a strange sonic dinner party at which Taylor Swift sits behind Richard Hell, who sits beside Aretha Franklin, who sits beside Jay-Z, who sits beside Loretta Lynn, who sits beside Ozzy Osbourne, and so on around the table. And you could throw a bunch more in there, Cole Porter, you name it. Anything that's not classical makes your screen.
You know, wouldn't you like to go to that party?
Oh, I'll I'm in. Let them bring their instruments, please.
And that's, you know, that's something that also I wanted to do. I wanted to be part of a movement that's reclaiming that word, pop, that makes it something that doesn't just end at the barriers of, you know, so-called disposable popular top 40 songs. Although I want to embrace and ennoble that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, Taylor Swift is a great songwriter in her own right. Even as she works with a host of producers and other songwriters to craft her words, there's something to be looked at as well in how she does what she does. So many millions of people can't be wrong, and I try to approach it from that standpoint. Certainly, I have my own tastes, and I might choose a very different dinner party, as we all would, as your listeners would, if they were to think about whom they would invite to sit around the table and bring their instruments. But what I wanted to do is inhabit this space of popular music in the broadest way possible, you know, really reaching across an entire century of music.
Let's get right into it. We're going to hear a lot of different sounds from quite different artists in this hour, but all in the popular music vein. I mean, Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, didn't show for the big ceremony, but they tracked him down. He was on tour in Sweden this week, and I sort of pushed it into his hands. He makes the list of people you want to talk about today, and we're happy to go there. Let's go right to 1963, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Bob Dylan.
I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken.
All right, Professor, take us in there. It doesn't take a whole lot to hear poetry or ecstatic visions or apocalyptic visions. Give us some poetic analysis of Bob Dylan here.
This is, I won't even give you my professor version. I'll just give you my Adam Bradley lover of music version.
Yeah.
And which, you know, those two identities have fused in writing this book, I have to tell you, Tom. Mm. But, you know, this, I wanted us to think about this song because this is a song that's so easily metabolized as poetry. It's so easily taken in, and people say, oh, well, yeah, of course that must be poetry because I don't understand it, because it has images that are opaque and difficult to grapple with. That's often how we think about poetry. The great English poet Adrian Mitchell once said that most people don't care about most poetry because most poetry doesn't care about most people.
Mm.
And I think that's the attitude that a lot of people have about poetry, is that it's something that keeps them at arm's length. And there's something about this lyric from this 21, 22-year-old Dylan that has that sense of the inscrutable, as a lot of us expect from poetry.
I saw a highway of diamonds, you know, with nobody on it. I saw a black branch of blood that kept dripping, a room full of men with hammers a-bleeding. Yes, and yet the music behind the obscure but potent language is constantly drawing us back in. It does care about us.
It does, it does. And that's the difference. That's the defining difference of a poet like Dylan, is that he has the resources of his music, of his voice, as strange and as wonderful as that voice is. He has all of these other resources to endow the language with the beating of a human heart, to bring in addition to the hidden references to Dante's Inferno and the biblical cadence that we see, the repetition, anaphora. I'll give you my lit professor word. You know, that repetition. I saw. Dylan said in the liner notes to the Free Will and Bob Dylan, on which the song appeared, that each and every line of the song he imagined could be a song unto itself. You know, think about that kind of concentration of language. And that's why it's easy for us to talk about Bob Dylan as a poet in a way that perhaps it might be more difficult to talk about, I don't know, Axl Rose you know, Jay-Z in those terms.
But it's pop music, so the range is wide. Taylor Swift, Shake It Off.
Play, and my haters gonna hate, baby. I'm just shake, 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 shake it off, shake it off.
Adam Bradley, shake, 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 shake. Are you putting that in the Nobel Prize category?
You know, give her another 15, 20 years and we can have the conversation again. But there's still the beat and the form of poetry is alive in those lyrics. It's necessarily so. But what we're also hearing is what popular music is oftentimes today, which is the product of a song not scrawled onto pages as Dylan wrote his song, but something that's produced in the studio with engineers. And you know, there's a great book that came out a couple years ago by the journalist John Seabrook. It's called The Song Machine. And
yes, we had him on talking about that.
Yeah, a fascinating book. And he talks about this song, and he talks more broadly about the idea of the track and hook method, which is essentially the concept that you need a hook, and not just in the traditional sense of maybe how we talk about the chorus mm-hmm. of a song, that part that gets repeated, but a hook every 7 seconds. and this song embodies that. So we have the hook of all hooks, which is the section we just played, essentially the chorus of the song.
Shake, shake, all, shake. What do you make of that, Dante? What do you make of that, T.S. Eliot? Shake, 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 shake. We're talking, Adam Bradley, please stand by there in Boulder, Colorado. We've got a lot more to listen to and to think about with you. The new book is The Poetry of Pop. We'll go out with the Rolling Stones. Can't Get No Satisfaction, 1965. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I wish I found some better sounds no one's ever heard. I wish I had a better voice and sang some better words. I wish I found some chords in an order that is new. I wish I didn't have to rhyme every time I sang. I was told when I'm
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the poetry in popular music, from Cole Porter to Pharrell to right there, Stressed Out by 21 Pilots. The lyrics behind the tunes that make us listen. Adam Bradley is out with his new book, The Poetry of Pop, and he's gone right deep into the lyrics. Music always right there beside it. You can join us this hour. What do you think? For you, does a great pop song need to have great lyrics, poetry in the lyrics? And what pop artists would you credit with writing poetry? Adam Bradley joins us from Boulder, Colorado. He teaches at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Lots of response online, people giving us their favorite lines here. Adam Gamble writes to us, quoting the poetry of the Smiths, "Punctured bicycle on a hillside desolate, will nature make a man of me yet?" Rob, Paul Simon, "I knew a man, he came from my hometown. He wore his passion for his woman like a thorny crown." Kelly says, "These lyrics are absolutely poetry. I was listening to Dylan's Masters of War this morning. Words with power equal poetry." Thinking there as Joni Mitchell goes to love the Hissing of Summer Lawns album Blue. They are timeless. They are poetry. You've got us right there with the 21 Pilots and Stressed Out. Okay, that's a sound. Take us to the poetics that you hear there, Adam.
Well, there's the playfulness even in the lyric itself, calling attention to the poetic demands of songwriting. He says something along the lines of, "I wish I didn't have to rhyme every time I sang." And he does
and
he that
doesn't.
In a line. Yeah, that doesn't rhyme. So the playful self-awareness of form. One of the things that hanging around artists as I've had the chance to do over the years, and songwriters, you see the conscious attention to craft, even in songs that wear that craft lightly, that don't call attention to their poetry. There's a sense for the balance of lines, the number of syllables in a line versus another, the arrangements of rhymes and rhythm. I mean, all of this is part of the conversation as people write songs, produce songs, and bring them to our ears through sound.
When you take it way back, you go back to Tin Pan Alley, and my goodness, you've got some greats there. I mean, Cole Porter, just incredible. Talk about clever, way beyond like hyper-clever lyrics. Totally different sound from 21 Pilots. But here's 1934 from Anything Goes, the musical by Cole Porter.
Anything goes, if driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if bare limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose.
Oh, I mean, I can just sit and listen to this again and again. It's of its time. You got Mae West in there and Russian Reds and Roosevelt and Rockefeller, I guess, but just so incredibly inventive, and the sense of humor in here so high.
That's it, Tom. And the other thing I love about it is if you hear it just the right way, you can almost imagine yourself as a 23-year-old hearing this song as it came out in 34, or as a teenager, what it must have been like for one's great-great-grandparents to have heard this and for it to be the pop music of its moment. It has an ever youthful sensibility in a strange way, even with the pop culture references. I mean, the Mae West of then is probably the Kim Kardashian West of today. Those kinds of playfulness, we see it in contemporary Billboard hits, especially in hip-hop.
I mean, you say, in a way, he's got the sort of braggadocio in here when he's calling out pop culture figures that hip-hop artists roll with all the time today.
Yeah, and even the flow. If fast cars you like, if low bars you like, that, you know, yeah. The rhyme leash, the repetition at the end, at the beginning and the end, actually, of the same words, the if-like construction. I mean, that too is something we see in, you know, hip-hop artists like Rick Ross, even, where there's that sense of repetition that becomes maybe more interesting by virtue of what the voice is doing.
The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, and then, oh boy, it's just great. Fred in Derry, New Hampshire is calling. Fred, you're on the air with Adam Bradley in Boulder, Colorado. What do you think, Fred?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your guest is no doubt familiar with the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poets.
Oh, yeah.
On Boulder, Colorado. I had the privilege, 20-plus years ago, hearing the late, great Allen Ginsberg do a reading there. His gig, I guess he could read there whenever he wanted, but I heard a public television interview with him one time. It may have been with Terry Gross. And he, you know, as all of us know, his poetry enjoyed a lot of mainstream parlance in the early 60s that kind of fell out. It hasn't regained that. And when Allen Ginsberg said he heard All the Lonely People, which was a Beatles, credit Paul McCartney for that one, he cried, knowing that poetry was going to find a life and continue to find a life in American society. Briefly, my original thought was just, and I'll be brief, as last night I happened to be looking up a song by Leslie Gore. It was 1961, called You Don't Own Me.
Oh, beautiful song.
I liked. Yeah, and then I was listening to the lyrics. It was like, wow, kind of wed to its time, but definitely a feminist statement, you know, and written by two men, but you don't own me, you know. So it's a timely, that, no doubts, I'm Just a Girl in the World, are two songs that have the sleeper feminist out there critique that you don't notice right away. I've used enough time, and I'll listen. Thank you.
Fred, thank you very much for your call. I mean, Adam, you know, people's tastes go in all kinds of directions. They find power and they find poetry in all corners of popular music.
Yeah, and one thing Fred took us to that I think is essential is that there is this correspondence between poetry and song lyric in performance. So, I mean, we think about Allen Ginsberg, we think usually about him performing his poetry. We think about him essentially singing
Absolutely.
His poems. Mm-hmm. So I think we ought to do more singing of poetry and more reading of song lyric. I think that both will be reinforced and enriched by virtue of that play.
You mentioned the Beatles, and you've got one from their repertoire that you threw out to us to play today. Hey Jude. It goes, you know, way back, but there's a 2015 remix that we'll play here. I want to play some of this and have you think with us about how you consider the poetics of the Beatles and Hey Jude.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her under your skin.
...2015 remix of the 1968 Hey Jude. Adam, I know this got that slow cadence to it. It makes it sound very simple. You say poetry? Tell us.
To me, if I could pick one song to sum up the poetry of pop, it's this one. And it's because it embodies both qualities that I see as poetic in song lyric. One is the opening 3 minutes, we get Paul McCartney's carefully crafted lyrics. I can take his lyrics to a class and have my first-year students analyze the rhyme structure, rhyming bad with sad, the heart with start, those sorts of things. But then at about 3:08, right near the where we started listening, the song completely transforms. It abandons itself, and for the next 4 minutes, they're saying na 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 na, hey Jude, 18 times, just over and over and again. And that too, though, is poetry. Even though you put it on the page and it doesn't particularly announce itself as fascinating, what is fascinating is how they keep our attention. They draw us in by adding little variations of melody, little variations in harmony, little riffs and noises and screams that make us want to keep listening for that 4 minutes.
But to me, that's the least poetic and the most strictly musical. It's just na 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 na. Am I being too literalist about it? I mean, na 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 na.
You know, poetry starts in sound. Poetry, yes. as my great professor from Harvard, Helen Vendler, said, poetry probably began with a scream. And so there's something that's elementally poetic about the cadence, the play of rhythm, the play of patterning and difference that we hear in that last 4 minutes that is equally deserving of attention. Although to do that kind of analysis as poetry, we have to hear it. It's not enough just to look at it on the page because it can't be captured in transcription.
So let it out and let it in. Hey, Jude. Kathy in Boone, North Carolina. Kathy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. I was considering starting out singing, "Don't tell me what to do, and don't tell me what to say," doing Leslie Gore.
Yes,
love it.
But but no, my suggestion was touched on by a previous caller, Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles.
Yeah,
mm.
And a particular line, Kathy, or where do you go with it?
Oh Lord, I used to teach English, and I would bring that poem in or that song in. For me, it's the last verse. Eleanor Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came.
Nobody came.
Father McKenzie, nobody came. Father McKenzie wiping his hand. Father McKenzie wiping his hands as he walked from her grave. I think I missed something in there. No one was saved. And beautiful. Then the refrain, all the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
Yeah. Right there, the Beatles. Kathy, I appreciate you calling. You don't own me. We'll sing together someday, Kathy. So what, Kathy, you say that Jude, hey Jude, has got your sort of vote for the most demonstrative of this link. What about the Beatles and their general handling of lyric and the poetics?
Adam? I mean, you have a wonderful sense of teamwork between Lennon and McCartney, but George Harrison also had some amazing compositions, particularly in 68 on the White Album. He has several songs on there that are standouts. And I think, too, that the difference, the way that songwriting gets us to think about poetry in a more expansive sense is the collaboration that's often involved in making a song work, of endowing the language with sonic form. I mean, it's the play between, also Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, where Mick said he would take the music that they had composed and he'd have to hang a melody on it using his words. And that was part of how he asserted his artistic contributions to the recordings.
You know poetry well, quite apart from lyrics. When you look at poetry, do you think, oh, I could take most poetry and if I had a great composer, I could write music around it? Or does a lot of poetry that's not written to be part of a song just not translate, Adam?
Most poetry written for the page carries its own small music, which makes it a little bit challenging to set in a new musical context. And that's why you don't see too many Shakespearean sonnets set to song, although I have seen a few. I think there's a way where song lyrics often have to consciously constrict certain elements, particularly when it comes to rhythm, in order to find their lives in the musical context of the melody.
You've got Pharrell Williams on your list for us today. He wrote for, what was it, Despicable Me 2. He wrote this song, Happy, which is kind of obscure at first and then became absolutely huge. I want to hear how you think about the poetics of Pharrell Williams. Happy.
Clap along if you feel like a room.
Okay, take it apart, Adam.
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is that strange metaphor he has in there, or simile actually, like a room without a roof. And I remember him responding to someone on Twitter who asked him, why is a room without a roof happy? And Pharrell said, it's metaphorical for one's space without limit. And I thought that's fine, but that's also not enough. It's not enough because similes like this demand from us a mental process of connecting the familiar and the unfamiliar, of taking this strange image of a room without a roof and making sense with it in our own minds, in our own hearts, of what that means, the emotion, the feeling that it gives us. And great figures of speech have the capacity to demand a response from the listener in resolving the seeming incongruity between those two parts. And also, it's just a fun song to hear, right? I mean, so danceable.
Do the lyrics support that kind of rhythm that gets you going three ways at once?
That's it. I mean, there's actually was a neuroscientific study done that looked at what makes for danceable grooves. And what they found is that it's a slight imperfection, that when rhythm is perfect, when things are perfectly aligned, when the voice is perfectly in the pocket, it can become monotonous. But when there's that little bit of syncopation, a little bit of difference, a little bit of human error even, that it makes us want to move. It makes us connect to the heartbeat, the human heartbeat behind even a pop confection like this song, maybe especially a pop confection like Pharrell Williams' Happy.
Diane in Appleton, Wisconsin. Diane, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Sure. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In my mind, one of the greatest contemporary poets who's touched the hearts and souls of millions around the world is George Michael. The CD of his, which is called Listen Without Prejudice, probably is one of the most outstanding pieces of poetry. The song that I'm thinking of that is so apropos right now with what's happening is called Praying for Time. And look, can I just read a couple of the words to you?
Yes, please.
The rich declare themselves poor, and most of us are not sure if we have too much, but we'll take our chances because God stopped keeping score. I guess somewhere along the way, he must have let us all out to play, turned his back, and all God's children crept out the back door. And it's hard to love. There's too much to hate, hanging on to hope when there's no hope to speak of. And the wounded skies above say it's much too late. Well, maybe we should all be praying for time.
Diane, I appreciate your reading that. Our time is short before the break. Adam, a lot of these are not trained poets. They're many start out as kids scribbling in notebooks, right? But do they get to the platform of the poets?
Well, I mean, it's just think of those words there. I mean, they have a kind of resonance and power, and you add to that the voice. I mean, George Michael's indelible voice, and you get something quite beautiful. And all poets are untrained to begin with.
Yeah. And poets still, and very much poets. We go out with Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now. This is her singing a reimagining of the 1969 original. This came out in 2002. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let them know.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the poetry and popular music from Cole Porter to Pharrell to Janis Joplin right there with me and Bobby McGee, 1971. The lyrics behind the tunes that make us listen. Adam Bradley is with us. He's written the new book, The Poetry of Pop, and he is deep into it. You can join us. Can you sing all the lyrics to Pharrell's Happy, to Janis Joplin's Me and Bobby McGee? What are the pop music lyrics that keep you going? Are we still writing pop music poetry these days? Adam Bradley joins us from Boulder, Colorado. People writing online. Adam, Nate writes to us, Joni Mitchell's lyrics equal his poetry lodestar. Then he quotes her, like Icarus ascending on beautiful, foolish arms. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. Lauren says, the lyrics of Trent Reznor live inside my soul. They're truly poetry to me. Look at the song Hurt, covered by Johnny Cash.
Oh, yeah.
Here's Mark. Love song lyrics. Listen to a lot of punk rock, and you'd be surprised at how many lyrics hold meaning and hope and value. Walter comes to us with this one. He says, I often discuss music with my 16-year-old son. He likes lots of rap, but also listens to older rock classics. Disagreements revolve around lyrics versus rhyme. I maintain that really great songwriters, Dylan, Mitchell, King, Springsteen, Wonder, and many more, wrote poetry with universal appeal, metaphors that are beautifully conceived, that they contain overall messages that are often profound and deep. My son argues that rap and hip-hop references are of the moment and talk about specific challenges of contemporary life. You've written plenty about hip-hop, Adam. What about the poetry of the sort of two different genres there, or three?
I mean, it's a wonderful thing. And I entered into this book with this idea that I would probably end up writing a lot about hip-hop, but I wrote a lot less than I imagined, in part because I think that hip-hop is at somewhat of a remove from a lot of other popular genres because of the nature of the voice in hip-hop, because of the proximity to speech rather than singing. Although that too is beginning to blur with artists like Kanye West, who bring such, Chance the Rapper as well, who bring a strong melodic sensibility. And there's so much to explore across genres. And one of the fun things to do is to dip in and to find genres that maybe otherwise you wouldn't necessarily choose to listen to. You find a new point of entry by virtue of looking at the lyrics.
Can you look at the sort of percussion of hip hop and give that poetic standing? I mean, Jeff writes to us, he says, even though his lyrics make me cringe, I'm always amazed at the complexity of the rhyme and rhythm structure in Eminem's music, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Eminem is a master craftsman when it comes to this play of rhythmic structure, what you call flow. I call it a dual rhythmic relationship between the voice and the beat, and a conscious awareness that the 4-4 beat that accompanies most hip-hop allows for the rapper, the MC, to create these flights of rhythmic fancy through their flows, taking all sorts of on and off structures in the way that they arrange their voice in relation to that beat.
Allison in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're on the air with Adam Bradley. Allison, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you know? What do you hear?
Well, there was just the whole conversation immediately brought Simon and Garfunkel lyric to mind.
Mm-hmm.
The words of the prophets are written on the subway walls and tenement halls.
Yeah.
And
silence.
I just think that it reminds us that poetry is everywhere. You know, it's in pop music. Sometimes I think we wait for it to come to us in big messages from who we think are big people, and it can be in the most simple of places.
Yeah. Subway walls and tenement halls and poetry in the very transmission of that idea. Not going to argue with that, Allison. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. Claire in Baltimore. Claire, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I personally love Lana Del Rey. I think all of her music is poetry, from her unreleased stuff to her newest album, Honeymoon. But what really sticks with me is the lyrics from her song Video Games, one of her most popular songs. When, like, it's really the whole chorus, but I love when she says, heaven is a place on earth with you. They say that the world was built for two. I just think it's so beautiful and honest.
Lana Del Rey, singing in the old bars, swinging in with the old stars, living for the fame, kissing in the blue dark, playing pool and wild darts, video games. Adam, what do you say?
I think that's it. I mean, what all of these artists do, whether it's Simon and Garfunkel or Lana Del Rey, is to take the everyday and make it unusual, to make us look at the things around us with new eyes, to listen with new ears. And great poetry of all stripes, great literature of all stripes, has the capacity to do just that.
Jill in Nashville, Tennessee. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Adam. I have to take us back over to the Beatles again.
Okay. All right.
I had a friend 7 years ago who died at the age of 30, after 3 days after a brain tumor diagnosis.
Oh, wow.
And the Beatles were her favorite. And after, at her funeral, they had a montage of all her photographs and playing to a Beatles soundtrack. And Yesterday came on, and Paul started to sing, "Why'd she have to go? I don't know. She wouldn't say." And I will never hear that lyric again without thinking of my friend and thinking of that moment at the funeral. And it just reminded me about how Paul McCartney probably wrote that song from a very specific personal standpoint. It became universal, and then it became personal again for me. So poetry transmogrifies itself. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Jill, I appreciate your bringing that moment back to mind for us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still thinking about it. Of course, these songs are powerful, and the lyrics are part of their power. But does power in lyrics, is that equal to poetry, Adam, or are you concerned with it, with a distinction or a fine definition?
Well, let's just take the song Yesterday, that beautiful song that we know now has is really known often for the lyrics, for that kind of way that it helps us connect with certain deep emotional moments. That song began as a melody in Paul McCartney's mind, and that he started to find words and syllables to drape on the melody so that he wouldn't lose it. He sat down and played it on the piano. He had this beautiful melody in mind. And so he just started singing the first words that came to mind. He started singing "Scrambled Eggs" instead of "Yesterday," just to capture the structure of the melody. And
it's kind of mind blowing when you think how powerful the lyrics ended up being.
I know that's true. And he ended up writing the lyrics with his mother in mind, and so it did have that personal connection that the caller talks about. Nonetheless, a lot of the power emerges out of the words in context of that indelible melody, a melody that sounds as if it's always existed. In fact, Paul McCartney was so concerned that he had somehow cribbed it from somewhere. He played it for all the guys in the band and for anybody who would listen, and said, where is this from? I mean, where did I pick this up from? Meanwhile, he had just plucked it out of the air, I guess.
But even if the lyrics are, I don't want to say just, but even if they're just drapery for the melody, you're ready to say poetry?
Yeah, well, only because, as you'll recall when we started talking close to an hour ago, that I don't think of poetry as an honorific. I think of it as a descriptor. I think of it as a way of describing what people do with rhythm, rhyme, and other tools of language. And most poetry written for the page that people do is terrible. Most songs that people write are terrible as lyric. Mm. That doesn't mean that they aren't poetry in a formal context of analysis, and that we can't glean something about their construction by virtue of looking at them in that light. In fact, sometimes you can learn more about how poetry works by looking at a flawed poem than you can at a piece of perfection that's hard to disentangle. Sometimes the seam showing actually helps.
Let's go to Matthew in New Orleans. Matthew, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Adam Bradley.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really appreciate this topic. I'm just concerned that, you know, just what you were talking about, his definition of poetry is a little bit too diffuse and flabby and therefore not useful. I mean, if I hear somebody talking on the street and he speaks in beautiful metaphors and similes when he's talking to somebody else, do I look at him and say that's a poem and therefore it's a poem? And question number two, I mean, why do you want to attach, quote unquote, this word poetry with this tradition? I mean, why not just talk about pop music as being socially important? And thereby, I mean, do you sort of interrupt its importance as pop music by associating it with this, you know, thing called poetry?
Yeah. Oh, I love both questions, Matthew, and I appreciate your call. Adam, what do you say?
That's great. I mean, the first thing I say to Matthew is that the difference between someone invoking simile or metaphor, which we all do in everyday speech, and someone writing a song or a poem for the page, is the nature of construction and distillation of language. Poetry and song lyrics share the same attention to peeling back the layers of language, getting to the least number of words as possible to say the most that you can possibly express. So part of it is that. And then to the broader question of why to class song lyric as poetry, I would just call attention to the fact that up until pretty much this past century, song lyric and poetry were synonymous. They lived together in most people's minds, in part because a lot of the music of poetry written for the page came out of the use of rhyme, which is pretty hard to find nowadays in most poetry written for the page. If you open up the New Yorker and you look for a poem there, you're not likely to find rhyme or clear rhythm patterns, you know, trochaic trimeter, iambic pentameter that Shakespeare used, for instance, in most of his sonnets. You're not going to find a lot of that. Where that sense of patterning in terms of rhyme especially, but also rhythm, where that's gone to live these days is in the song lyric. So that it's less of a, I think, a rupture in poetry to think of song lyric as coterminous with it than we might think if we take a broad view of the history of poetic development. It's really kind of a modernist era moment, you know, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, that moment where we start to pull back away from some of the musicality and song form that traditionally has inhabited things like Shakespeare's poetry or the poetry of Wordsworth and Shelley and Keats, where there is a kind of song form at times in the lyrics that they write.
Here's one I didn't expect to see on your list of things we might listen to. Idina Menzel, she sat across the table from me not so long ago. Here she is from Frozen, Let It Go.
Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. Let the storm rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway.
Okay, we're in Disneyland now. Where's the poetry? How do you describe it?
Well, the poetry is first of all, this is a necessary lifeline for me. I'm the father of two young girls, ages 6 and 3.
Oh boy, so you've heard this a couple times.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, pretty much the poetry of Pop as I wrote it was a record of my early fatherhood. And one of the things that I had to do, of course, is live at the level and at the time structure of my children, so living in 30-second increments. And part of the way that I could work on my book and be present with them was to listen to the Frozen soundtrack. And these are, you know, really carefully wrought songs written by the husband and wife songwriting team, you know, Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. And the thing that kept bringing me back, and you can hear it in Idina Menzel's rendition of this song, is the emotional power of the performance. And you know, when I talk to people about the poetry of Pop, the first thing I say is, you know, don't go looking for rhyme structures. Start with the feeling. Start with your own response on an emotional level to the music you're hearing. What parts of the song are you drawn to? What parts maybe do you reject? Where does your ear take you? And you settle in those moments. You read yourself almost as an emotional seismograph. And then, you know, isolate those moments and figure out what's making them work the way they are, whether it's a matter of voice or something in the lyric. You can start to unpack it, and that's the beginning of a poetic analysis of a song, beginning with feeling, not ignoring what we love, and in fact working from that, and then moving to the structures and the more technical aspects.
Here's
that's the only reason to do it.
Yeah, here's a very different direction. Shape of You, Ed Sheeran.
The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go. Me and my friends sat at the table doing shots, tripping fast, and then we talk slow. And you come over and start up a conversation with just me, and trust me, I'll give it a chance. Now take my hand, stop it, and the man on the jukebox, and then we start to dance. And now I'm singing like, girl, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for somebody like me. Come on now, follow.
Okay, me and my friends at the table doing shots, drinking fast, and then we talk slow. Poetry?
Why not? And I mean, this goes to show it's not just about the profundity that makes it poetry. It's in here, it's the play of rhythm, the balance of syllables, the 12 syllables in the first line, 7 in the second, 11 in the third, 8 in the fourth. We get this back and forth, this kind of cadence that he creates in relation to that tropical beat that's going on behind it. This is a song he wrote with the idea of giving it to Rihanna. And he just found himself, when he started putting lyrics to it, that it was more fitting with his own experience with his friends, you know, drinking fast and then we talk slow. So he made it. He said, let me make it my own song.
With pop classic lines, though. Girl, you know I want your love. Yeah, you don't get more pop music than that. Your love was handmade for somebody like me. Adam Bradley, this has been really a pleasure, both to read and to talk about with you. We'll go out with Try a Little Tenderness from Otis Redding. Yes. Hey, who's going to argue with this? I'm right there. I hope you keep bringing all this poetry and music to our ears, Adam, and just keep it coming. It's a tremendous lot of fun. Thank you very much for being with us today.
This was so much fun, Tom. Thank you.
Adam Bradley at the University of Colorado Boulder, joining us from Boulder, Colorado today. His new book is The Poetry of Pop. We'll go out with Otis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.